I would like to start the hearing. And we don't have a quorum. We'll wait on officially calling it to order, but I would like to start the testimony. We are going to be hearing today from the PCA on the facet rules that have been drawn up, and this is an issue that's generated a lot of interest and discussion, and I would like to first introduce the Deputy Commissioner, Tim Schirkenbach, from the PCA, and also Lisa Thorvig, who is here with us today as well. Thank you for joining us. If you would state your name for the tape, please, and please begin your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Schirkenbach, Deputy Commissioner of the PCA. And with me is Lisa Thorvig, who is the director of our municipal division. Actually, Lisa's going to be going through the presentation. She was involved with this rulemaking and managing all the different staff involved in it. I'm here because, as you had said, Mr. Chair, this is a controversial issue. So if there's questions at a different level about the agency on some of our decisions, I'm here to help respond to those. So with that, I think I'd turn it over to Lisa.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Schirkenbach. And Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Thorvig, the Municipal Division Director. And I'm here to talk about our legislative report on the financial assurance and siting rules. And just to remind you, in 2008, the legislature adopted some landfill laws, and there were four pieces to the legislation. The first was a direction to the MPCA to facilitate a stakeholder group and for that group to report on construction, demolition, and industrial landfills by January 2009. And we fulfilled that requirement. Then the law laid out two concerns about land disposal of solid waste. One was about location and groundwater sensitivity, and the other was about sufficient financial assurance. And that piece of the law directed the MPCA to adopt rule amendments to address these two issues. Then the third piece, there was a moratorium placed on certain types of new landfills. And that moratorium does not expire until the rulemaking is completed. And finally, there was direction for the PCA before we move to rulemaking to come back to the legislature and report on the proposed rules and how we met these legislative mandates, and that was a requirement by January 15th. So we have delivered our legislative report on the rulemaking, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. There, as we've written the report, we've identified a couple of legislative needs that need to be addressed this session. The first is that the rulemaking authority that we were directed under in 2008 expired in November of 2009. So if the legislature wants us to continue on with the rulemaking, you actually need to reauthorize us to proceed with rulemaking. The second issue is some clarification about the laws adopted in 2008. The first one is the question, does the directive to write solid waste disposal rules based on an area sensitivity to groundwater contamination cover existing landfills as well as new landfills? There has been concern, and you'll be hearing more about that the legislation was only supposed to apply to new landfills, and we read the legislation as applying to both existing and new landfills. So a clarification from the legislature on that would be very helpful. And then second, in reviewing the legislative directive to ensure that there was financial assurance sufficient so taxpayers would not have to fund issues at landfills, we actually found that there is another statute that caps financial assurance at mixed municipal sanitary landfills after 30 years of post-closure. And so we need clarification from the legislature on which directive do we comply with. Do you want to limit landfills' liability to 30 years, or should it extend for the length of time that there continues to be a risk to the environment And so that there is no need to, for taxpayers to get involved in post-closure issues. So those are the two issues that we'd like some clarification on. A little bit more on the expiration of the rulemaking authority. The Administrative Procedure Act requires agencies to propose rules within 18 months of receiving the rulemaking authority, and this includes amendments to the rules. Our authority expired in November 2009, and the rulemaking will be halted if the legislature doesn't act. But also, it's important to point out the moratorium will stay in place if the rulemaking doesn't continue. So there is a dilemma there that needs to be addressed as well. Then the directive on the rule amendments was, the first one was on location, and the directive was for criteria in rules that should prohibit solid waste disposal in areas sensitive to groundwater contamination. The second directive was that rules should ensure landfills have sufficient funding so taxpayers don't have to pay the cost of cleanup, the cost to clean up groundwater if contaminated by leaks from the landfill. In terms of the location issue, what we're proposing in our legislative report is to prohibit solid waste disposal location in groundwater sensitive areas. And we're defining that as areas where the groundwater flow is unpredictable, so we can't monitor whether the landfill is actually leaking, or whether where the plume moves really fast, so that if there is a leak, it's hard to remediate and clean up the problem. But landfills can still be designed and operated safely in sand and till and clay areas. In fact, we looked at what we were proposing and worked with the DNR, and we know that in every county in the state there are places where you can locate landfills. So it isn't a huge area that's covered by this prohibition. In terms of the financial assurance, the legislative directive again was to ensure public doesn't have to pay the cost of groundwater contamination from landfills. And we have, in developing the rules and looking at our current rules, we've identified certain weak points in the current financial assurance rules. The types of mechanisms we allow, the reliability of cost estimates for closure and post-closure care, and long-term funding needs. The draft rule would remove surety bonds and self-insurance from the list of financial assurance types that could be used, but would allow cash trust funds and letters of credit. Also, counties, and I know you'll be hearing from the counties with financial assurance usually uses trust funds, and that's because that's about the only mechanism they can use. So there is some concern about other types of mechanisms that counties might be able to use, and you'll be hearing more from them on that. But I just wanted to highlight that we have heard that issue as well. The other concern is for demolition landfills, especially the ones that have been operating and haven't had to have financial assurance, and how to cover those landfills. And what the agency is proposing is that demolition landfills would only have to set aside money for closure. And unless there is groundwater contamination at a demolition landfill, they would not need to set aside money for post-closure care. They're a lower risk type of facility. The other issue that we've identified is whether the 2008 directive on financial assurance fits with older laws. And the issue here is that in 2008, the directive said new rules should ensure taxpayers don't have to pick up landfill costs. So the obvious solution is for landfills to maintain funds for the full length of time that the landfill poses significant risk to groundwater. But state law passed in about 1993 capped sanitary landfill financial assurance at 30 years after closure for mixed municipal solid waste landfills. We know more about landfills now and the design of landfills with liners and leachate collection and gas monitoring, and we're not sure that 30 years is going to be long enough for some of these sanitary landfills. So there is a conflict or a reconciling that needs to be done with the 2008 directive and the 1993 directive. If the legislature gives us the authority to continue the rulemaking process, we will continue the informal stakeholder process first. So the legislative report described the initial draft rule proposal we went out with and also the comments that we received from stakeholders on those rules. It also talks about some things, some changes we could make to address those comments, but we did not do a second draft because we're really waiting to hear from the legislature and the direction that you're giving us before we start to move ahead on a second draft. But we do intend to work with stakeholders informally on a second draft, collect comments, and then propose formal rules within the 18-month period that is allowed by the law. So finally, just kind of a summary or a reminder on what's needed in 2010 from our perspective is the need to renew the rulemaking authority and clarify legislative intent on two issues, existing versus new landfills related to the groundwater sensitivity issues, and how to rectify the new legislation that says insured taxpayers don't have to pay with the fact that in 93 we capped mixed municipal solid waste landfills at 30 years post-closure care. And with that, I'll be happy to answer your questions now or later.
Okay, well, thank you. And at this point, I will officially call the hearing to order. And we do have to approve the minutes from the last meeting of February 16th. So Representative Anderson moves the minutes from the meeting of February 16th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. And thank you, Ms. Thorvig. And are there any questions for our testifiers? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Ms. Thorvig, for a concise report. Appreciate that this time of the day. Looking at your slide on page 3 about the financial assurance, I'm curious to know why you would allow a letter of credit but not some kind of a bond. Could you explain that, please?
Ms. Thorvig.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I am not the technical people working on that. We do have technical staff, so could I get one of my technical staff up to answer that?
Sure. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
David Richfield, R-I-C-H-F-I-E-L-D. Chair and members, as for that issue, we've gotten advice from one of our staff attorneys on this, and who's been researching this issue for 20 to 30 years. And the problem with surety bonds is the ability to collect the money and have it in hand when the actions needed to operate the landfill and protect the environment need to occur. There's often a time delay in collecting on surety bonds, and during that time delay there would be no clear mechanism to fund the activities needed to ensure environmental protection. And that's the problem that we've reached conclusion on with surety bonds for this specific application.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. What about piggybacking or utilizing a county's bonding authority to satisfy this requirement?
Mr. Richfield.
One of the counties did ask us to look at that issue, and we've begun researching it. That is an approach that was used temporarily many years ago and authorized by the legislature for specific circumstances. We were converting from the old dumps to current-day landfills, and at least our preliminary conclusion is that may be a viable second alternative for counties to utilize. but that is just a preliminary conclusion. We're still doing more research on that issue.
Okay. And Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thorvig or whoever wants to take it, on page 3 there, the bottom slide, talking about 30-year endpoint won't protect taxpayers at landfills where risks stretch for decades longer. But indeed, is it, when you do the risk assessments on some landfills, is it decades? Isn't it, doesn't get into centuries or anything? Or do we know?
Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think we know. And where we might have been more comfortable in 1993 to say 30 years would certainly cover it, now we're not feeling as comfortable for all landfills. And this would be, you know, the financial assurance requirements would establish the financial closure and post-closure costs for a specific landfill, and then it would have to be covered for. So some landfills may be just fine in a shorter period of time than 30 years, and others might stretch for much longer than 30 years. And the current law does not give the flexibility to provide that taxpayer protection for longer than 30 years from our mixed municipal solid waste landfills.
Representative Purcell.
Quickly, Mr. Chair. I just, more than just curious, that as we move forward potentially with your recommendations, what kind of a number you would expect that we should look at beyond 30 years. And you may not have it today, but we're going to need to know that.
Ms. Thorvig.
And Mr. Chair and Representative, we don't think that we could come up with a cap, the maximum amount of time where we can be assured that there would not be any risk from every single landfill in the state. That's why we're thinking that there shouldn't be a cap, that each landfill be treated uniquely based on the waste they accepted, their leachate collection and gas system, and you know the various things that go into a specific landfill. And then if the assurance, the care needs to occur for 40 years, that will happen. If it's only needed for 20 years, we'll be able to accommodate that. So we're saying that we shouldn't have a cap if the 2008 legislation was the will of the legislature to say that Minnesota taxpayers should never have to foot the bill for these currently operating and new landfills.
Representative Purcell.
Just quickly, it sounds like we need a permanent fund here. Do we have such a fund that we can continue to build, or do we need a new fund? What, any opinion?
Ms. Thorpe.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I am not an expert on our closed landfill program, but we have taken over the long-term care. The state has taken over the long-term care for 112 landfills, and we've spent in excess of $250 million kind of on a three-legged stool: bonding authority from the state, solid waste tax funding that we collect from waste producers, and then the insurance recovery, where we went back after insurance companies that insured these old landfills and we've recovered those costs. My understanding is that fund is not very healthy, that the costs of the closed landfill program has been more than we thought it would be, and so that is not a good fund for the existing operating landfills. And in fact, in the legislation for the closed landfill program, there was a time period where landfills could close and come into the program and get the state to take them over, and it was the understanding, though, that if you continue to operate those landfills, you would be responsible for the financial assurance in the future.
So Representative Purcell.
I'm sorry, but this is
no
just
problem.
So right now the taxpayers are borrowing money to keep this fund going, or at least in part, it sounds like.
Through the bonding, and in fact, in the bonding bill, there is another proposal for, I'm not sure, the, you know, $10 million or something like that for the next 2 years for the closed landfill program.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thorbig, how many of these landfills have failed in the last, say, 10 or 15 years, and what type of evaluative criteria do you use to determine whether or not we need this type of surety?
Ms. Thorbig.
The current operating landfills, and we're talking a range from the mixed municipal solid waste to industrial landfills to combustor ash landfills to the demolition landfills, I don't know of one that is failing right now. We have some existing sanitary landfills that currently have liner and leachate collection, but they also have unlined areas. And in those unlined areas, we do have groundwater contamination that is being addressed at those landfills, but the current state-of-the-art landfills with liner and leachate collection systems are working well in the state right now.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the second part of my question, what are the criteria by which, you know, we would determine kind of some of these surety levels and whether or not at what point in time we need to go? Are those landfills, good well into the future, and we feel that they're going to be okay?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, we don't know how long into the future we need to take care of these landfills. That's, you know, each one might be a little bit different. But what we have is we have groundwater monitoring systems around the bigger ones that have more risky waste in them, so we can detect if they are leaking. And we have set up, you didn't ask me that question, you asked me about financial assurance. I'm sorry, I'm gonna back up. We actually have procedures on how we calculate for each given landfill the closure costs as well as post-closure care. And the permittee of the landfill is responsible for first providing cost estimates, and then as part of the permitting process, our permitting staff look at that and we come to agreement on the financial assurance needs. So it's part of the permitting process. We're talking here in this rulemaking about the types of financial assurance that needs to be available so we're assured that we have the funds necessary at the time of closure, and then if they're for post-closure care, and then if there's problems or actions needed because of problems that we detect post-closure. And so this rulemaking is more about the mechanisms than how we estimate, although I think it is bringing in for the first time demolition landfills. Okay, Mr. Richfield's going to help me. I've clearly exceeded my knowledge on this topic.
Okay, Mr. Richfield.
Mr. Chair and members, we're proposing a performance-based threshold that determines the length that financial assurance and post-closure would be required. And it's based upon environmental protection thresholds and benchmarks. For example, we would utilize the Minnesota Department of Health standards for groundwater. And if a company can demonstrate that the materials in the landfill and its leachate no longer are capable of contaminating groundwater above those threshold levels, then we would consider that landfill to have arrived at a safe operational circumstance where financial assurance would no longer be necessary. That's just one example.
And Ms. Thorvig, I was wondering, you'd mentioned, as far as locations are concerned, you talked about the different kinds of soils where it would work and where it wouldn't be a threat to groundwater resources. And you said that every county has those locations available. But a question that I would have is how many of those landfills are located in those types of areas that are not sensitive? Because the concern is with the existing landfills, how many of those are in locations that you deem unsuitable and therefore are threatened with possible closure?
Mr. Richfield?
Chair, members. We I should add that the situation with each county is somewhat variable across the state. In some counties, it would be far easier to find landfill locations, and in some, especially in southeastern Minnesota, it would be a bit more of a challenge, but there are areas, even in the toughest counties in the state, to site landfills under this envision future rule condition. There are sites available in every county, but some are more challenging than others. I just wanted to clarify that aspect of it. And could you please repeat the second part of the question?
Yeah, and then I was wondering about existing landfills, because these rules are, mm-hmm. are applied to existing as well as new landfills.
We did a preliminary rough analysis of this, because some of the data that would be fully needed to do a complete and formal analysis just is simply not available at this point in time. But our preliminary analysis shows that only roughly a small handful of landfills would not be capable of meeting the new proposed locational requirements.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Thorvig.
The other thing I wanted to point out is that we believe that you need to give existing landfills time to, you know, these rules would apply, the siting, the locational requirements would apply right away to new landfills. But for existing landfills, we're proposing a 10-year time frame where they would have to make other plans. So the compliance date for existing landfills would be more 2025, so they would have lead time for those handful of landfills that can't meet the siting requirements.
Okay. And in talking about time, I was wondering, as far as the time necessary to put these rules together, if you felt that was adequate to address some of the concerns being expressed now. Did you hear these concerns during the process? I assume you had a stakeholder process. And I was just wondering if these concerns were adequately addressed, or if these are some new concerns that you're hearing now.
Mr. Chair, I think we're in the starting stages of rulemaking. We're not in the ending stages. So we put out a preliminary draft, and we have had one round of comments, and we have thoughts on how to address some of the concerns raised. But we wanted to first come to the legislature and get some clarification and direction. For example, if you don't renew our rulemaking authority, we don't want to spend more time on these rules. And so we wanted to hear first from the legislature, but our intent, if the legislature does reauthorize the rulemaking, is then to address the comments we received, come out with another draft rule, and solicit more comments on the second draft. We would have 18 months to actually formally propose, so there would be more time to do a stakeholder process.
Okay. And Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank the agency for the work they've done on this, and also my colleagues, Representative Saylor, who worked with me on this. First of all, I'm one of the authors of the original bill, the chief author, in 2008, but Representative Saylor worked a great deal on the CDI portion of that work group portion, and Representative Wagrinius on the financial assurance portion. I was more focused on the siting portion. But most importantly, I want to thank all those solid waste management professionals that are in the room, and moreover, who took part in the processes in the summer and fall of 2008 in a very long and detailed CDI work group processes, producing a very useful report, I think, for the legislature and the agency moving forward, and then more recently with the various stakeholder input and process this last summer and fall with resource to doing this one. Just a couple comments and questions. First of all, on the issue of the clarification of legislative intent, I was present at several of the CDI meetings over the first fall and interim, just to be an observer and hear how that process was going. I have attended almost all, if not all, the major public meetings to get feedback from the larger group on that, and then also more recently on this. And moreover, we already passed another session last year in which we met. And during that entire time, not until December of this last year, did I hear discussion raised about legislative intent in terms of the scope, whether it was only forward-looking or backward-looking, etc. And so I just have a question about, you know, what am I missing about process as to why you couldn't raised that question earlier, either informally with the authors of the bill, even prior to last session, but certainly during last session, so as to save everyone some time.
Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, frankly, there was no question in our mind. We thought the legislation was clear that it directed us to write rules for both existing and new. And so we never raised the issue because we always assumed coming out of the 2008 legislation we were talking about existing and new. And it wasn't until we had the draft rules out and a larger group of stakeholders started to look at the rules that the stakeholders themselves said the legislative intent was only for new rules. And so the clarification is needed from, and I know you're going to be hearing from a number of people, and perhaps they can explain, the agency, we thought the language meant, when it talked about in the language, the rules for the disposal of solid waste shall include, it didn't say the rules for the for new solid waste disposal. Mm-hmm. And generally when we're directed to write rules that only pertain to new and expanded, there's some kind of qualifier in the language, and that wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you that my staff and I, we never even raised the question with others because in our mind we thought the legislative intent was clear.
Okay. Representative Bunn.
Well, I think that was not actually the legislative intent, at least for portions of it. And I think there were specific exclusions, in fact, which kind of hinted at that it was a little more forward-looking than that. But that's something we'll take care of now that has been brought up in the weeks ahead. But just one last thing on the financial insurance side, and it's kind of a bigger picture issue and more pertains to your committee's work. But both in PCA and DNR, because we have issues with financial insurance on the DNR side this session as well, there's discussions of financial. To what extent is what you're proposing or even had in the past up to this time consistent with what other agencies do in financial insurance? And is there cross-agency conversations about consistency and also ensuring that the staff working in this area have sufficient expertise in this area?
Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I know that we shared our financial assurance, our commissioner's office shared our financial assurance proposal with the mining group. Mm-hmm. To make sure that we were on the same page as what is being proposed for the mining. So if that's what you're referring to when you say DNR, we did compare notes and we are consistent in our approaches.
And Representative Saylor.
I have a couple of questions, one of which really just referring to some of Representative Bunn's remarks and with regard to notification of people. When did people, hear? What was your process for getting input from the solid waste community? When were they notified of meetings? Just tell me a little bit more about that process, if you would.
Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd like to ask Dave Richfield to respond to that.
Mr. Richfield.
Chair and Representative, in many ways, the process started right after the 2008 legislative session. We began the CDIL work group. That's when discussions actually that eventually carried over into this rulemaking began. So that's a couple of years ago now, almost. There's been a lot of interaction. Established an email network with everybody that we were aware was interested. It was open for anybody that expressed interest to join. There was no exclusion. We made efforts to maintain contact with the various, I'll call them trade organizations, such as the various county groups like the SWA group, for example, and maintain contact throughout with them and many others. Did everybody that was potentially interested find out about this? No, it actually came to our attention a few months ago that some members of the demolition landfill community were not aware of this, but we corrected that problem and have reached out with them and I've done everything we can to make sure that people like them and anyone else we've accidentally missed has had an opportunity to participate in this and share perspective.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor, again, and we feel like we're early in the process, and there is still time for everyone to get involved and to comment. We don't want to exclude anyone. In fact, it's a better rule if everybody's on the same page, understanding the rule and what's needed to implement it. So our intention is to be inclusive, not try to limit who participates. It makes for a better rule.
You may have better attendance at the next stakeholder groups that you have. So
I'm sure we will.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to this point, I was just wondering that, you know, would the Solid Waste Administrators Association be one of the first ones that you notified of this? That was a yes?
I'm sorry.
Okay. I just wanted, you know, for the record, because the nods don't, you know, record very well.
Oh, Ms. Thorvig, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Saylor, yes, that was a yes. And what the Deputy Commissioner is whispering to me is that we probably need to correct our answer on the DNR financial assurance. And so I'm going to let him speak. I was a third party in hearing about all of that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Schertenbach.
Part of the problem, there have been so many different discussions on so many different issues here that I think that's what we're at. Looking back over the history of this, again, we tried to work in good faith on all of this. There's a lot of different questions relative to financial assurance and that idea of what vehicles are considered appropriate. And what has been brought to my attention, we have had discussions internally with our mining team to understand in their discussions if we are clear and how we line up with DNR. But the sense is we probably need to go back and check on that and talk to DNR directly, because they have a little different approach, it appears, on having criteria versus we look at it overall as far as the overall outcome and what we see as the overall, in a sense, liquidity, or the fact is it there and actually readily available. So there's a little difference in approach, so that make sure we can say that there's a consistency, we have to go back and check on that. So, and that's the trouble. And a lot of you say, how do you compare? Is one more or less? And the trouble is, if they're different in the framework, sometimes it's hard to make an absolute answer. So we want to go back and make sure as we respond to that.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to follow up. I hadn't quite finished with. Thank you for your answer about notifying the Solid Waste Administrators Association. Just because I was just curious as to why the president of that organization had informed me that he had not heard from Nathan Cooley, or, you know, whoever was putting together the email listing that most people were hearing about until December 2nd of 2009. And that was a little concerning that, you know, I recognize it's hard to get everybody all together, but the president of the Solid Waste Administrators Association, one would think, would be kind of right at the beginning of that list. So perhaps as things move forward, we can, yes.
I just Mr. Schertenbach, since I've been here probably longer than anybody, the riddle in all that is we try, and over the years we continue to try, but there's always the riddle on how do you know who doesn't know that was therefore not notified. And no matter what, how hard we have tried in all these type of things, I can remember time and time again where we hear that somebody didn't know about it. And so I can tell you, we take that as seriously as we can, because it does us no good to have somebody later on come in, but it's still something we haven't totally solved as far as how to make sure that everybody at some point in time will express interest, didn't initially know or know at some time. So,
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I can appreciate that it is a challenging endeavor to get everyone notified. I have a separate question from this, and this isn't even to do with financial assurance, but I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the current measures that the PCA has in place to assure that C&D landfills, for instance, are not accepting disallowed materials. Can you tell us a little bit about your process of assuring that that happens across the board throughout the state?
Mr. Richfield.
Chair and members, we use our compliance and enforcement process to work with the landfills to make sure that they're following the procedures that we've both require, and we've also made some technical assistance-oriented suggestions to do things like waste screening, where they actually visually inspect what's going in and ensure that materials that should not be going into demolition landfills are going there and things along that line. But we spend quite a bit of time working with them, mostly in a technical assistance mode, but when necessary, compliance enforcement, activity-oriented mode.
And I did have one question on the financial assurances. As far as our public entities, are they? Is there any different treatment of public entities as opposed to private entities on landfills? It's because there is a difference, obviously, as far as risk to the public, and the public entities are publicly owned already. So I was just wondering if there's any difference in what kind of financial assurance is required.
Chair and members, current rules make no differentiation, and the proposed rules in their current informal state that we're seeking the direction clarification on makes no distinction, but in the course of our initial dialogue about this informal version of the rule, it has been pointed out that there are some differences with the counties. They don't have access to certain financial assurance mechanisms that the private sector does, is one example.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Saylor.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I just have a little more follow-up with regard to the earlier question on how you work with C&D landfills to make sure that disallowed materials are not in there. How many, you know, inspections do you do? You said you mostly work on a training level and, you know, kind of working that direction. But do you do inspections? Are they announced? Are they unannounced? Do you get, you know, equally around the state to all areas to assure that, you know, there's not an, that all landfills have the same advantage or disadvantage and are held to the same standard in actuality?
Hi.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the team.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Pulford. I manage certain aspects of the solid waste program at the PCA. Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, the inspection, the question of inspection of C&D landfills. First of all, C&D landfills are required to provide us with industrial management plans. We agree with their plans in the sense that we approve the types of materials that they can accept. We also have guidance that very clearly lays out the type of material that certain types of C&D landfills, and there are three in our guidance, can accept. So that's kind of the upfront, if you will. Clear understanding on all parties concerned as to what a particular C&D landfill can accept. To follow on that, then, there are inspections of those same facilities. Those facilities are inspected at least once a year, and in many cases, many more times than that. Currently, there are at least two enforcement actions pending regarding unacceptable materials being accepted at C&D landfills that have been uncovered through our inspections and we're following through in a compliance manner.
And I think we'll have one more question and then move on to the next testifiers. Representative Gardner.
Just quickly, thank you, folks of the PCA. Hello. Do you know how many MSW landfills outside Minnesota we send our MSW to, including waste energy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner.
Mr. Bowfield, is it? Did I say that right?
Both, Mr. Chairman. Pulford, P-U-L-F-O-R-D.
Mr. Pulford. Pulford.
Mm-hmm. Again, Representative Gardner, the current number is somewhere between 3 and 5, depending upon what day of the week it is. And those are sanitary landfills, for the most part.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, I know we don't have the exact information, but I know, for example, in the area around Winona and La Crosse, I think La Crosse has a garbage burner, and some of the Winona waste goes across the border to that incinerator, and I don't know if that's happening elsewhere. So on the incineration, I'm not as sure as on the sanitary landfill.
Thank you, Ms. Thorvig. Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony today. And next, I'd like to have Annalie Garlitz from the Association of Minnesota Counties and Mike Robertson from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the committee, and before you testify, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Robertson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I am happy to be here today with Annalie Garlitz from the Association of Minnesota Counties. We're here today representing a pretty unique coalition of local government folks and private sector owners and operators of landfills from around Minnesota. We also represent, of course, the associations that advocate for government and business interests in the state. And the facilities that will be affected by the draft proposed rule that the Pollution Control Agency has put out and that was discussed in the report that you received will be affected very significantly by that rule. We believe that the proposed rule will increase costs to local government, to businesses, to all citizens of Minnesota by forcing the premature closure of many existing facilities and result in waste being shipped out of state because the permitting of new facilities will be much more difficult. Now, we have about 100 members of our coalition. I think you have a list of those folks in your packet, who represent more than 40 counties and some cities. I think there are about 30 private facilities represented in our group, and many of them are in attendance today. And I don't, could you guys just kind of indicate that you're here? So we've had a lot of folks involved, and there's been a lot of dialogue recently since the draft rule was proposed by the agency. We want to thank the PCA for the many hours of meetings with stakeholders on this issue. The working group that participated in this process, those professionals from our group and others, reached two conclusions, I think, in that process. First, that landfills are managed now better than ever. Most, if not all, instances of groundwater contamination that have been found in unlined landfills that predate the current regulatory practices. Second, the permitting of landfills should be based on three factors, which we refer to as the three-legged stool. Lisa was talking about a three-legged financial stool. We have a three-legged stool on the siting issue. Those three legs of the stool are local site characteristics, waste type, and engineering controls. Now, I want to add a little bit that might explain some of the concern and the process issue about, you know, there seem to be questions about, well, weren't you discussing this with these folks? And I think throughout this process, there was a lot of discussion about the three-legged stool. The issue being, how do you account for site suitability as you discuss the three-legged stool? How do you provide more attention to the issue of groundwater sensitivity? We thought that as we went through that discussion, as our folks on the professional side, engineers and landfill managers, that there was kind of a consensus within the group that these were the three factors. We needed to get to the point of determining how much more attention needs to be placed on the issue of site sensitivity as we thought the legislature directed. Unfortunately, the PCA draft rule adopts an exclusionary policy. If their proposed, and this exclusionary policy only really became known to the group very late in the process, in that draft that was published on November 30th. If their proposed exclusionary criteria of karst geology and the groundwater flow, and our folks who are coming up can talk more in detail about that, but the karst geology criteria is that if there is less than 50 feet of overburden of karst geology, then you could not site a facility in that location. The groundwater flow issue is how fast does water move through the area, and if it's under their criteria, if it's less than or more than 1 meter per day, then the water was moving too fast and you couldn't site a facility there. So the impact of this exclusionary policy is even more dramatic because it would apply to existing facilities, not just the siting of new landfills. We believe the approach is extreme, it's unnecessary to protect groundwater, and as I already stated, we believe that will have serious economic consequences for the state. So when the five-year permit for an existing facility expires, the exclusionary criteria would apply. And if an exclusionary factor would exist with regard to that existing facility, a permit could only be issued or reissued for that facility if the PCA board grants a variance. And there would probably be other exceptions. There are what are called exceptions within the draft rule to other requirements that may be necessary that would have to be granted by the commissioner. Facilities that could not obtain variances would have to close within 10 years. The proximity to landfills is very critical to, of course, our individual citizens, especially in rural areas, as well as businesses that must dispose of their industrial waste in a proper manner and in an economical manner, and that really means distances from the location of disposal. If such disposal options are not available, we risk more illegal dumping in rural areas, as well as increasing greenhouse gas emissions and higher costs because wastes must be transported greater distances. Now, the folks who manage the facilities that are represented in our group, after the meeting that we had with the PCA, public meeting on December 7th, where the PCA said that they didn't think very many existing facilities would be affected by these criteria, went back and looked at their own facilities, and they have concluded that most facilities represented in our coalition would have to obtain a variance or an exception. And we think that this kind of policy would really be unprecedented. It's regulating through variance, which is bad policy. In current practice, variances from rules are intended to be rare and surely should be rare, but the result of this rule would be to make variances the norm and create a public perception that existing landfills do not meet standards and are not safe.
Okay.
And I will turn it over to Annalise.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Let me just clarify. I think you are only talking about current landfills. You are not talking about new landfills. Have I got that right?
I was just
Mr. Robertson. Adam,
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I was just talking about existing landfills, that variance issue, correct?
Okay.
Because any new landfill that didn't meet these criteria would never reach the point of being permitted, which will be another issue. There will be very few areas of the state that could permit a new facility. And I think we're going to get more into that in a moment.
One of
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. One of the reasons for taking care in our permitting process is that if we have to deal with groundwater issues, it's going to cost someone a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Is the chamber testifying that if one of these current landfills leaks into the groundwater and we're in a position of having to clean it up or provide drinking water for a community, that we can raise the solid waste tax to pay for that?
Mr. Robertson.
Chairman, Representative Wagenius, it's interesting that you bring up the solid waste tax because the original purpose of the solid waste tax was to deal with solid waste issues, finding other ways to manage our waste and to, as with the amendments that you passed in, I think, 1994, to take care of the landfill issues. And it's the record of the state so far that we haven't really used all that money for those purposes. So, you know, the current tax is 17% for businesses. It's 9.75% for all of us folks at home. I think there clearly should be a debate if there's a need for an increase in the tax for protecting our facilities, then that's a debate we should have. But it's within the context of a debate that we've tried to have for years, that the money that was that is from the solid waste tax should have been used for the solid waste purposes from the beginning. And just to point, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bulgenius, as you will see in the next part of our testimony, we're not saying that there shouldn't be more attention to the site sensitivity and the groundwater issues in evaluating a site. And we're going to talk in a moment about alternative ideas on how that can be done, aside from this exclusionary blanket exclusion approach that has been proposed in this first draft by the PCA.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be impossible not to comment that in the governor's proposed budget, it appears that he is taking money out of from the solid waste tax and spending it as a general fund appropriation. And so I think perhaps you and I would agree that that's not the best idea. Am I right?
Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenius, I would totally agree. But the record of the governor and the legislature, wherever there has been a budget deficit, the record of the legislature has been to use money from the environmental fund, the solid waste tax, to take care of the general fund deficit.
Well, not under my watch.
And I think we'll move on next to Ms. Garlitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I have tripods, so just wanted to take a moment. Mr. Robertson mentioned that we had some maps to show you, and after we found out about the exclusionary, and I believe you have these in your packets too, if you. But we thought that the bigger maps really showed this well. The exclusionary criteria are shown in detail on this map, and then you can also see that we've indicated where there are existing facilities, and you can see our concern with if those existing facilities had to apply for all of these variances, and if they weren't able to obtain them in the future, what the problem would be. And then on this map, you can see the white area. The white areas are the only areas that don't have an exclusionary criteria that's applied to them on this map. And keep in mind that these areas also have local zoning. This doesn't show where there's an individual homestead in rural areas. So there's additional criteria that aren't indicated on this map. And we have a black and white map that, so you don't focus on all of the individual colors. The black areas on this map are the areas in the state that you would possibly, again, considering local zoning and individual residences and the like, the black areas of the state would be the areas that you would be able to conceivably site a landfill in the future. So, and you have those maps, like I said, in your packet. We believe that the directive in the 2008 legislation for site-specific criteria can be accomplished with a different approach, as Mr. Robertson mentioned. In your packet is a position paper on siting criteria that was prepared by people working in the field that describes the approach. Essentially, the alternative would use hydrogeologic criteria to trigger a higher burden of proof based on site-specific testing that a site is acceptable for permitting. The rule would define a special review process to identify site conditions requiring enhanced studies that would provide a step-by-step completion of accepted outcomes before a permit could be issued or denied. This alternative is consistent with the approach in other regulatory jurisdictions, and we believe that this alternative accomplishes the legislative objectives more appropriately than doing something such as blanket exclusions throughout the state. And I'd like to note that our next speakers are solid waste industry individuals who will be able to talk about the real-life impacts of the exclusionary approach. And we've mentioned some of the impacts, but they'll be able to go into a little bit more detail about how it might impact, for instance, public facilities. As you've heard, as we've talked about a little bit already, the draft rule would also amend financial assurance requirements for landfills. There's not enough time today for a detailed discussion on these issues, and we also would like to note that the draft would broaden financial assurance requirements to all landfills, limit acceptable financial assurance mechanisms, and potentially extend the post-closure care requirements. And as noted, public facilities would have some additional concerns about what they would be allowed to utilize for financial assurance. The group has found overall that a more thorough analysis and discussion of financial assurance mechanisms and impacts is necessary. And PCA also noted that we've just not had enough time to really discuss and dig into all of the details that we need to look at before more is recommended. We find that the PCA should convene a group of experts and stakeholders to more carefully evaluate and document the need for changing financial assurance requirements, the impacts of changes proposed by PCA, and other options to achieve the legislative objective. And finally, I would just like to note that the group of individuals that are here today and listed on your paper believe that the current siting and financial assistance rules do protect the environment as well as the taxpayers of Minnesota. However, if it remains the desire of the legislature to increase the emphasis on hydrogeology in siting landfills, we hope that you clarify the directive. And also, we would hope that blanket exclusions should not apply to the existing facilities. And with that, I will stand for and take any questions that you might have.
I thought I would ask, again, in regard to the number of existing facilities, landfills that would be affected by this. You'd mentioned, Mr. Richardson, that many went back who have the landfill operations and came to the conclusion that they would be one of those, many of them at least, came to the conclusion that they would be one of those that would fall under the exclusion and would end up possibly having to close down. Any idea how many we're talking about, percent? Or I know it's probably, maybe it was just more anecdotal coming in from people who testified.
Our guys are telling us virtually every existing facility would have an exception or a variance that would be required.
Okay. Thank you. And I assume, as far as the finding an alternative way, again, it was testified by the PCA that every county would have areas that would be acceptable, but as the map shows, it appears that there are some counties where it would be very difficult to find a location, and the distances could be very great for traveling, and you talked about the greenhouse effect that would have and some of the costs of the transportation. So I assume that was the reason that you're looking at the alternative options here. Representative Wagenius, you have a question?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand. Are you saying that every current landfill that we have has potential groundwater problems if it leaks?
Mr. Richardson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, no, because those facilities that are cited under the current regulations have protections that are required in their permits that prevent groundwater migration or monitoring so that they can be detected. And as I said earlier, we've heard no presentation from the PCA about groundwater problems from facilities that have permits under the modern landfill regulations.
Representative Wagenius.
That wasn't my question. I mean, the modern landfill regulations haven't been in force long enough for us to know if they're going to last 30 or 40 years, so we don't know the answer to that question. So my question is, are you saying that every landfill that we have now has potential groundwater problems if it leaks?
Mr. Richards.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Richardson. Representative Wagenius, what we're saying is that the criteria, the exclusionary criteria in terms of making a blanket exclusion, that there may be conditions that where, I mean, you'll hear in the next, from the next speaker, that his facility does not meet the 50-foot of overburden on karst geology. And that is the next speaker that you're going to hear about. And he will tell you what kind of protections exist at that facility. So I'm not saying that there is a pollution that or a problem at the facilities that would require a variance. I'm only stating that the criteria that the agency has selected would require a variance from that, and many facilities would have to get a variance because that karst feature is 50 foot of overburden is not there, or water may flow that's not meeting that standard that they've proposed in this rule.
Okay, and I'll take three more questions, and then we'll move on to the next testifiers. But Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, I'm looking at the colored map, too, and I'm looking at St. Louis, Cook, and Lake counties, and critical habitat for Canada lynx. I'm trying to make the connection to groundwater there. Why do we have that exclusion?
Mr. Richardson.
Representative, I think this map is intended to portray the exclusionary factors or potential exclusionary factors that exist within current rules and the rules that would be proposed under the draft proposal. And so there are requirements that you can't site within certain distances of national parks and other kinds of facilities, and those features are shown on these maps.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Robertson, I'm kind of curious. You've said how MPCA has developed these guidelines that make, and when I look at the map, I think of just outside my district, the SKB facility is clearly in the white area. It would, no way it would work. Almost the entire county of Washington is white. There's just a couple of specks of black. There's a couple of specks of black in Hennepin County, but some of them are located in the middle of the city of Minneapolis. So clearly there should have been another overlay given, I think. But I just want to follow up. You've noted that MPCA has laid out these rules, but the reality, MPCA laid out the rules because we passed a bill that told them to do something. And unfortunately, when I begin to look at this, there was, we talked about the site-specific concerns we had, which were very important. But I'm thinking about this. Shouldn't we have also taken into account the kind of waste that's going into the site? And then the other thing that really hit my interest, when we began to think of things we should do in the Washington County landfill, we talked about how we had to move that big amount of material from where people had dumped, including 3M. And we needed to move it, and they talked about, well, we could be safe and we could put it in a double liner facility, and then that would give us a kind of a double assurance of being safe. And I remember once in the committee I was saying, well, if we want to be double safe, let's be triple safe. And it ends up that's what we did. And I know I'm oversimplifying things, but that's my background, to kind of cut to the chase and get simple here. We didn't take that into account. This, I think you mentioned, or MPCA or somebody, I drew out the stool. We didn't count engineering and put a value on that. So if we're worried about it leaking, and we're really worried about it leaking, should we make a double or should we even make a triple protection? And then does that change the program? And I'm wondering, it looks like maybe we missed that when we drafted this legislation.
Mr. Robertson.
Representative McNamara. You're talking about the three-legged stool that we think should be the process that the agency, and it is the process that the agency has used to issue permits for facilities that they have said are protective of the environment with the issuance of those permits. And the exclusionary proposal is to use only one leg of the stool. Now, we fully agree with the legislative directive that we should be taking stronger a look at site suitability and hydrogeology. And there, as we have proposed a way to do that, but still not abandoning the other two legs of the three-legged stool.
Representative McNamara.
But I think we're on the same page, but I'm trying to understand. I'm thinking SKB, and I think many of us have been there and understand that, and their facility and the protections they're making, and, you know, the financial assurances that we've put on them already. If I understand it right, this is white in their area. They're going to have to come and get a variance. I mean, this thing is, I mean, this thing, for you folks that are driving down Highway 55, you got to look. They got this great big huge new machine. If the economy ever turns around, they're going to be sorting the construction debris. They're not only, they don't want to bury the construction debris, they want to get the metal and all the different products out and reuse them. So what this says, they've got to go back to process, and we're going to shut them down, the way I see it. I mean, I'm assuming variances are going to get turned down. I don't assume variances are going to be passed. If they're going to be passed, why are we putting them in there? You got to assume they're going to get turned down. Why are we closing that place, or why? That seems to me that's the effect here. And to be honest, I haven't talked to them. I know Ryan's standing up there. I look back there to see him, but I haven't talked to him, and it's not even in my district.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Robertson, McNamara, I think that's the point I tried to make earlier, that regulating by variance is not a good approach. The public will not understand that, and if we only give variances in very slim circumstances from rules that we've said should apply to everyone, then why should SKB get a variance? And so we're very concerned about that, and if you know, I would suggest that there are reasons probably why SKB should get a variance because of other legs of the stool that are dealt with in their permit. But this exclusionary, blanket exclusionary approach, if the variance were granted, they would have it. But if it wasn't granted, they'd be gone in 10 years and the facility would no longer be able to operate.
Okay. And the last question, Representative Bunn.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, unless I understand it correctly, regarding the map and the colored one, first of all, many of these constraints, like the one that Representative Drakowski was referring to, mean, I believe, not that a site can't be located anywhere in that county, but there are conditions. So there may be portions of that county or not within a certain distance of something that related to wildlife and endangered species. And that is true with very many of these. So when they talk about the white map, many of these just mean there's some kind of constraint within that county as to where it could be located or under what conditions. It doesn't mean they can't be located in those counties. And then finally, to the one, the part that's most relevant to the current rulemaking is the brown areas. That's, although there may be exceptions to that, the kind of the karst bedrock issues. And when the legislation was originally passed, even within this brown area that looks like it's solid brown, first of all, there was testimony at that time that in almost all of those areas there were sites that would meet the conditions we were looking for a sensitivity to groundwater. And moreover, we have more recent examples like in Olmsted County where it essentially looks all brown, but they use this type of criteria for sensitivity to groundwater to locate a new site to find a place that was inherently more suitable and more productive to do. So it is more difficult in an area like that that's all brown to find appropriate site, fewer of them, but I think that both BCA and outside experts from the U.S. Geological Service had testified that it's not that sites don't exist, but certainly would be fewer of them without such considerations.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I think Ms. Garlitz.
Mr. Chair, if we can get Mike Hanen to go, he has to travel back to Otterdale County this evening. So
sure.
We'll save the Olmsted County example that Mr. Robertson referred to just recently until after Mr. Hanen goes, if that would be.
Sure. And I was thinking of having all three maybe come up to the table. But Mr. Hanen, you can go first. And Mr. Duran and Mr. Seams, you can come on forward too. So, welcome to the committee, Mr. Hanen. And if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Hanen. I'm the solid waste administrator for Otter Tail County and Wadena County. And I also work quite closely with the officials in Todd County. And a lot of my comments are going to be related to the facilities in those three counties. And I'd like to start with some general information and then some more specific information regarding our facilities. But right now in the state of Minnesota, there are approximately 104 demolition landfills. Of those landfills, 70 of them take less than 5,000 tons of waste in per year. About another 15 of them take somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 tons a year, and the remaining 19 of them take in greater than 10,000 tons per year. In our counties alone, we have five demolition landfills. Of the five demolition landfills, three of the five fit in that smallest of the small group, taking in less than 5,000. There are about 3,000 yards a year that we take in at those facilities. Of the remaining two that we have in our three-county group, we fit into the biggest group, but barely. We take in about 12,000 yards a year, and the cutoff for that biggest group of 19 facilities was 10,000. So we're very small facilities. And when I look at some of the siting criteria, and I think Mr. Robertson and Ms. Garlitz did a very nice job of discussing the group that met and some of the thoughts processes that we came up with, and certainly I think one of the things that came out of that group was the whole group saying, yeah, we understand the legislature's desire to protect the groundwater, and we applaud it, and we're all for that. But we need to look at some of these facilities and say, what's going to happen if some of them close? One of the items that comes up in the rules is that all these facilities would have to do type 1 or phase 1 through 4 hydrogeologic evaluations. And we've had some of consultant firms look into what those costs might be. And those costs range anywhere from $60,000 a year up to as high as $128,000 a year. And when you're talking about some of the facilities in our area that are taking in 3,000 cubic yards a year, you can pretty much bet that those facilities can't afford $60,000 for their hydrogeologic investigation, much less $128,000 based on that 3,000 tons per year. And with that, you know, you start looking at what's going to happen to those facilities. You know, I said I represent three counties, and we're a pretty big area out in west central Minnesota, ranging from almost the North Dakota border to getting fairly close to Brainerd, east to west, and from Detroit Lakes south past Fergus Falls. And it's a big area, and I'm looking at our five facilities and saying certainly three of them are going to close. There's a good chance that the other two might have to consider it when we start to factor in some of the financial assurance requirements. Now, these are all publicly owned facilities. None of us are going anywhere. We're going to be here 20 years from now, 30 years from now, at least I certainly hope so. But when we start factoring in some of the financial assurance costs that go along with it, there's a good chance that we would have to make some decisions on those even two larger facilities that may be able to stay open. And when I look at the locations of those, there's people within our three-county region that are going to have to go a minimum of 75 to 80 miles to get to one of those facilities. I don't think that's going to happen when you start looking at some of the commercial projects, maybe. When you start looking at the smaller residential projects, the likelihood that Ma and Pa are going to throw their demolition debris in the car and drive it 75, 80 miles to the nearest facility, it's going to get pretty unlikely that is going to happen. Beyond that, I look at some of the siting requirements that are in the rules, and I understand the agency's talking about modifying some of those possibly, but when I look at some of them, they alone would probably close our facilities. Early on, when I attended the meeting, one of the first meetings that the agency had, there was a discussion of trying to put the rules into one place so that we could all understand them. What ended up happening is a lot of the rules came together, but they picked pieces of the rules that maybe didn't apply to demolition landfills originally and may make them apply to them now. For instance, right now our demolition landfills are required to be 50 feet from the property boundary. The new rules may require 200 feet. All of a sudden, our facilities went from, you know, a reasonably decent-sized facility to a very small facility. Some other things in there may even make it so that we couldn't even get a permit. And I really want to build on Mr. Robertson said. You know, I believe we've gone through several permitting processes, siting processes. In the public arena, if you're coming to the people and saying, yes, I've got a facility, and yes, it makes sense for us to have this facility here, but I need 3 or 4 or 5 variances to do it, the public is going to take a look at that and say, if you need 3 or 4 variances to get this started, it's not a good idea. And frankly, standing in front of a crowd of people, I'd have a hard time disagreeing with them. But these facilities that we have out there right now, we do quarterly groundwater monitoring. We're regulated on what we can bring in the way of waste. We think we manage our facilities very well, and they serve a very real public purpose. And that's really all I wanted to say today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hannon. Are there any questions before Mr. Hannon has to leave? Okay. And Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Mr. Hannon. I'm assuming that you want people to go to these smaller facilities rather than bury on site. I mean, is that what you're trying to do?
Mr. Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner. Yes, exactly. Our county's made a decision a long time ago that we wanted to know where the waste was going. We permitted and open and operate these facilities so that we can provide our residents with a choice of a facility that they can go to that is permitted, that is monitored, rather than the on-site burial. In fact, our county is one of the few in the state that adopted within our ordinance rules saying that waste disposal services are available countywide, and therefore you cannot burn and bury on your own property.
Sorry, I didn't want to bring up burn barrels, but that was a good one. No, but there's an advantage to having it go to your facility also because of the stuff that might come in that otherwise would have been buried on site, like thermometers and or thermostats and that kind of thing. Is that right? Or ballasts, stuff that might come out of a building for demolition.
Mr. Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner. Yeah, that's exactly right. We have a screening process at our facilities. We also have an educational process. When people come in, we explain to them what can come in, why. We don't just say you can't bring it here. We explain to them why it shouldn't go to this facility, what the proper methods for managing that waste is, whether it's ballast, whether it's fluorescent light tubes, whether it's thermometers, you know, whether it's, you know, liquid paints, any of those types of things. We have an educational process. We like to have those people show up at our facility so that we can go through that process with them.
And Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hannon, I'm just wondering if you, maybe, pardon me if you already said this, I didn't get the chance to hear everything you said, but I'm just wondering, could you comment on how likely it would be for counties to be able to meet that 10-year time frame in case, you know, they ran up against that situation? What would that mean to Otter Tail County or any other counties in your area if you know that?
Mr. Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, but I think you're referring to that 10-year time frame of either being able to meet the permit and the permitting requirements or making a decision to close the facility. I'm thinking that in looking at our facility, I think it's pretty clear that the three smaller facilities would probably close. There'd just be no way that we could even consider keeping them open with some of the financial assurance requirements alone. Beyond that, some of the siting requirements we can't meet. You know, whether it's the you know, in some of the rules, there's the discussion of a setback from a state or federal highway. I mean, we can't change that. It is what it is. So, you know, our facilities, two of them are affected by that. We'd probably have to ask for a variance. And there again, I mean, what to, you know, get a variance today, but come in 5 years from now or 10 years from now and have different staff people, different administrators, and say, no, you can't get a variance. I don't know that I would say that all five of ours would close, but I'm certain the smaller ones would really have a difficult time staying open.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one little follow-up question on that. With regard to some of the other characteristics, not aside from the groundwater, you know, if that was the problem, that would be one issue. But you mentioned something about setbacks. How often do you think that is the problem, the criterion that cannot be met with regard to existing landfills? Is that, you know, you mentioned it with one with a setback from a federal highway. How often do you think that is kind of one of the determining factors in most of these?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, I don't know that I can answer it other than our five facilities. And in our five facilities, all five of them would be affected by one of, at least one of the setbacks.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Hannon.
Thank you.
Have a safe drive back.
Yes, thank you.
And next, do we have, is it Mr. Seams or Mr. Dorn? Mr. Seams? Welcome to the committee, if you could state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Dennis Seams, S-I-E-M-S. I'm the Olmsted County Landfill Manager. I've been working there for Olmsted County in the Solid Waste Division for 27 years, 21 of it in a management position. I've also been involved in virtually every rule writing thing that the state has done, guidance documents, the TD&I task force 2 years ago. I've been through many of these processes. I'm here to give a case study of Olmsted County's landfill, and maybe first of all, just bear with me, I would like to, our landfill is the foundation of our integrated system down there. It's Dodge, Olmsted County's solid waste integrated management system. We've got $160 million of infrastructure we've built down there. The county's worked hand-in-hand with the MPCA all through the years since the early 80s to develop the system that strives to manage most of our waste above ground. We've wholeheartedly joined in with the agency to try and do that. Our system reduces greenhouse gases because we manage the waste different than alternative systems. Our system consists of waste reduction. We have a waste reduction coordinator for our county. We have recycling. We recycle at a 49% rate. We have a four-county regional hazardous waste collection system, yard waste composting, resource recovery, which is waste energy, and of course our Kelmer landfill. The Kelmer landfill is the foundation of this system because you have certain number of things that have to go to a landfill. This rule, the way it's written today, this draft rule, could jeopardize this whole integrated system, jeopardize our landfill and our whole system, and cause us to close in 10 years. If you look at some of these maps and what people have been pointing out, there may not be anybody really close by where we can take our waste that we can't manage at our other facilities. So we would probably have to haul to Iowa. This would have an effect on our tip fee, as near as I can tell, of about $16 a ton. We have I'm pretty sure we probably have the highest tip fee in the state now because of this great system we built. And that $16 a ton would have a horrible effect financially on us. I mean, how much higher can we go with our tip fees? That's important to remember here. And also hauling that great distance to another facility would have a great effect on greenhouse gas emissions, much more than we do now. Waste receipts are down 6% for us because of the recession that's going on, so we're having trouble with our budgets already. This kind of a $16 increase in our tip fee to haul to another facility potentially could cause us to default on $85 million in bonds we have out there on our system. So this has a domino effect on our whole system if our landfill doesn't turn out to be suitable in the eyes of this new draft rule. Now to our landfill. We are in, if you look at the colored one, the brown area. Olmsted County, it virtually looks like it's all karst. Back starting in 1983, we went through a seven-year process of looking for a place to put a landfill in Olmsted County. It was very detailed. We spent over $1 million trying to look for this good site. And believe it or not, we did find a very, very good site in Olmsted County. We found a 1 mile wide by 3 mile long buried bedrock valley that is filled in with, for the most part, 100 feet or more of clay till. So this is a very, very good site to site a landfill. And then I remember on top of that, we put line systems and leachate collection and all that type of thing. But the sad part of this story is this new rule, as written today, would require me to go out and try and obtain 4 variances or exceptions to this rule. And I have this exceptional site, but the way this thing is written right now, I would have to get a variance or exception from the setback distance from a stream, from the high water mark of a pond, from wetlands, and here's one that's really key, 5-foot separation from the seasonably high groundwater table. Now, if you know anything about hydrogeology at all, if you're going to go to a clay site with tight soils, you're going to have groundwater issues. You're going to have perched water tables, high groundwater. So if you look at these maps, the black areas on here, on this one that we say are good for landfills, are probably all clay sites. If this 5-foot separation from the seasonally high groundwater remains a prescriptive criteria in this rule, you can turn that whole map white virtually. There's not a place in Minnesota you could site a landfill. So if you look for the good clay site, find this good site, here I sit having to get 3 or 4 exceptions or variances. This is a problem for us. People brought up the political barrier during re-permitting, the NIMBY thing. Here I stood up in front of 75 angry people and told them why this was a good place to put a landfill, and we discussed it with them over 5 or 6 meetings over several years as we were setting this. We seemed to satisfy them. They're happy with our operation. We have no problems with our operation. But now they're going to get wind that I need three or four acceptance or variances. You're going to say, if you need 3 or 4 acceptance or variances, this is a lousy place for a landfill. But it's not. It's a very good place for a landfill. So that really concerns us in Olmsted County. This landfill is the foundation for our integrated system. Now, on the financial assurance side, I'd just like to make a couple of comments on that. We're talking about modern-day landfills today, like Kalmar, that have not shown any liability thus far, and we hope that never will be. A couple of things to consider. The PCA talks about their $250 million they spent on the old landfills. They were all online facilities, virtually every one of them. Some of them had partial liners, but you have to remember there was no household hazardous waste collection, no VSQG programs back in those days. Hazardous waste went into those facilities too. Today we have those things to weed out the worst of the items from the waste going into our facilities. Plus we have these well-designed facilities with leachate collection and liners and the gas management and all that type of thing. So I think the way financial assurance is in rule today probably is adequately taking care of our liability. Now, they brought up the real long term on this. We don't know the answer to that, but I think that we need to step back. I don't think that we can write a rule right now. I think the agency should be required to meet with professionals in our industry, us operators, as a task force. We'll work with the agency. This long-term care for landfills is a very, very difficult thing. But if we work together, I think we possibly could come up with some solutions. but to simply write rules saying that all of a sudden your 30-year closure care period turns into 60, and oh, by the way, you can't use your 30-year post-closure care money till 31, what's the facility going to do after they've closed up? They have no more income coming in for that first 30 years. Doesn't make sense at all. So I'm recommending that we get together as professionals and the agency and a task force and really tackle the financial assurance program. The agency maybe thinks that we weren't real concerned about financial assurance in our comments on December 7th, but you got to remember how quickly this progressed. We didn't see this draft rule until November 30th. They had a meeting on December 7th where we all attended and asked tough questions and tried to figure this out. And in fact, they didn't have their act together at all on financial assurance other than to talk about vehicles like surety bonds and trust funds and those types of things. But when it came to this other portion about long-term care and what was going to be required, they had no answers for us. So we didn't know how to comment. So the fact that they got very few comments on financial assurance isn't indicative of potential problems there. We just didn't have time to review it properly and discuss it. They didn't have any real answers for us that day. And then we had to have comments by December 18th, and here we are today. So I'd like to see us take a time out on financial assurance. You can move forward potentially on the siting criteria and that type of thing, but we need to take a time out and work together to come up with a long-term solution for all our landfills in Minnesota. Okay. I guess that's all I have, so I can entertain questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Seams. And I think we'll move on to Mr. Doran next and then take questions after that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Fred Doran, engineer with R.W. Beck. I'm a professional engineer with 25 years of experience in the solid waste management area. I've been helping clients in Minnesota address and comply with the current solid waste rules since they were promulgated in 1988. I represent one of many consultants that are part of this coalition, professional engineers, professional geologists, who by our license are required to protect the environment and protect groundwater quality. And I guess I wanted to just ask with a raise of hands any of the engineers and geologists in the room here to the coalition to identify themselves. And I know there are more that are a part of the group that weren't able to make it. I was a member of the stakeholder group that was involved in the CD&I landfill report, January 2009. Also been a stakeholder with regard to the demolition debris landfill guidance, leachate recirculation guidance, and also the transfer station rules. So just like Denny, I've been involved in a lot of the guidance and rulemaking activities. From a professional that's had to work on the engineering side, the permitting, the design, the operation, to assist folks like Denny here, in my 20 plus years of experience permitting and designing within the regulations of the state of Minnesota, the rules have been successful. They have protected groundwater quality with the facilities that have been designed and sited and installed under those rules. As mentioned by Danny and a few others, these rules have been supplemented by guidance and by policy within the agency that has strengthened that protection. Example are the waste exclusions for household hazardous waste, electronic waste. And when you look at the demolition landfill guidance that was done, I believe in 2005, that really increased the scrutiny on hydrogeologic investigation, monitoring, looking at the various waste types that went into facilities like that, and then the engineering controls that would be reflected by the type of geology and the type of waste that are put in those facilities. We've mentioned the three-legged stool in that the January 2009 report by that CD&IL group hammered home the idea of that three-legged stool, that when you have a landfill, land disposal facility, it relies on understanding the waste type, understanding the geology and the site conditions, and really matching the engineering with that. And it's a society issue. As an engineer involved in a variety of other types of projects, you look at petroleum storage, like underground tanks. They're relying, you know, they're in sensitive areas, and they rely on engineering to protect the groundwater quality. Water and wastewater treatment, relying on engineering to protect surface water quality. And even, you know, the design of this building for our safety as we're here talking about this issue. Engineering is important in all levels of society. Regulating land disposal without considering the benefits of engineering and looking at the waste type that's going into that facility, is it practical? It's not economical. As mentioned, it's going to impact the taxpayers and businesses of Minnesota if this rule as it's currently written would go forward. These restrictions would, you know, would make facilities close. Options for disposal would be more remote, most likely in other states based on the mapping we've presented here, and the costs would go up. We've talked about the different variances. I guess one thing I wanted to address as a question before is the colors on that map are to reflect the variance items that are in the proposed rule. That's why they were shown there. Some of them don't relate to groundwater quality, as we mentioned. Some are distance away from highways. The rules, the different siting restrictions for a variety of facilities were kind of pooled into one section and applied to all facilities. And so that's what created that map. Based on that, you know, I work with public facilities primarily, and I wanted to identify two examples on how these proposed rules would impact them. And again, as mentioned, you know, with Denny, the counties have been, you know, they've had the responsibility of taking on solid waste management in the state. And they've had to fund a lot of the programs through their revenues and tax structure to try to meet the requirements in recycling, special waste management, that kind of thing. One facility I'd like to talk about is the Lyon County Regional Landfill near Marshall. Southwestern part of the state, it serves seven counties, low population, primarily farming and businesses that rely on farming, you know, that kind of area. If you look on the map down there, it's at, you know, it's kind of that area southwest of the Minnesota River down there. It's a clay environment. Based on that map, you would think, oh, it's in an area that could meet these exclusion criteria, but as Denny mentioned, with a clay environment, you have shallow groundwater. Groundwater there is within 5 feet of the ground surface. What we did with that design is we were proactive in the design. We did what's called a zone of saturation design for the current expansion that was put in 2 years ago, where we actually built the liner within the groundwater table. And we put a groundwater collection system underneath that liner. So all the groundwater, and again, remember, this is clay, so the groundwater flow is very low. That groundwater flows to the system, and then we collect it, and we monitor that. So in essence, we have engineered the hydrogeology around the site to always make the groundwater flow toward this facility, and the county made a great investment for that protection. Because of that design, we are within 5 feet of the groundwater. But we've depressed that groundwater table. Another thing, that criteria that would kick in at that site is a wetland setback. Also, as this facility expands, we are within 1,000 feet of Highway 23. So the criteria that have been, you know, exclusionary criteria that would apply to this facility. If this would close, the waste would likely have to go to Iowa. They'd have to build a transfer station. We'd have to haul it on there. And the current tipping fee is $45 a ton. It's remained that for, you know, since it became a line facility in the early 90s. Our estimation with adding the hauling, adding the transfer, would move that tip fee up to $82.50 a ton. That would increase on an annual basis per household $50. Again, an area that relies on farming, and even in a good economy, has a tough time making ends meet. Greenhouse gas emissions for hauling that waste to a different state, we estimate 900 metric tons a year of emissions that would go into the state, as opposed to, you know, keeping that waste in a location and possibly doing a gas to energy project, which we're looking at. Another facility, another client we've done work for is Hubbard County up by Park Rapids. They have two complexes that do both municipal solid waste transfer and also construction and demolition waste disposal. One near Bemidji, one just on the edge of Park Rapids. And the Park Rapids facility would be in what would be characterized as a rapid groundwater environment based on the criteria. Also would be impacted by the property setback. You know, so a site that's like this would now be a, more of a postage stamp on that property. The north facility up heading toward Bemidji is adjacent to a wetland, so it wouldn't have the wetland setback. It's also next to a state highway. If those facilities would close, that waste would have to be collected, probably would move down to Park Rapids to one location, consolidated, and then transferred likely to North Dakota. Again, and Hubbard is a situation, and a lot of counties have done this, where they have no tipping fee for residents and they have commercial tipping fees for businesses to try to get the residents to make the best use of the programs they provide. And with this work going on, and because it's a low tonnage county, I'm estimating $145 a ton to manage this C&D. $73 a household per year, and hauling it would cost 160 metric tons of carbon into the atmosphere. Also, being a demolition landfill and financial assurance requirements on that would increase per household $5 per year to meet the financial assurance requirements that are would be part of this new proposed rule.
So I think I just mentioned too, with the lateness of the time, if you could wrap it up, that'd be great. Thank you.
I've done work in 25 states in Canada. I cannot think of one instance where a line facility has had a leachate release that has impacted groundwater. The current design that's reflected in these rules has worked. As mentioned before, the experience the state has in the closed landfill program with the Washington County landfill does not reflect the design operation of the current facilities that are regulated. The current rules are protective of the environment, as Denny mentioned. We do need to have some discussion on financial assurance. But I guess the other, so I think the rules as they are, they'll change it. You know, the changes that the MPCA proposes are not necessary. And I think also there should be some consideration because of depleted airspace that the moratorium should be removed pretty soon.
Thank you, Mr. Doran. Representative Wagenius has a question.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the advances in engineering in this. Have you advanced to the point that private insurance companies will insure these landfills?
Mr. Doran.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius. Don't know if I can answer that from the perspective. I'm not sure where the private industry is at right now. I know that from the public facilities have millions of dollars set aside for the MSW landfills where they're required. The privates have mechanisms set up to do the same thing.
No, but I think the reason you fall back on the public funding it is because private insurance companies aren't trusting enough yet. But maybe they are. And I think that's one of the questions that we need to pursue, Mr. Chair. Are we at a point that private insurance companies will insure? And if that's the case, maybe that's the question we should be asking. Will they insure these landfills? Because if they will, that means we don't need the same assurance rules where we're paying for it. And I don't know the answer. I know that that would be a good mechanism, but I anybody can help with it.
Yeah, is there anybody who would have the answer to that question? What the private insurance would cover?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say
and Mr. Doran?
That would be something, if we have this subsequent discussion on determining what's appropriate for financial obligations and then what mechanisms are available. I think that's a discussion that should occur.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And we'll bring up the last group together here. We have Commissioner Bill Paul Krebeck, is that correct? And also Mayor Dean Johnson, Mike Elmo, Peg Larson from the City of Lakeland, Councilwoman, and also Dave Engstrom. So,
Mr. Chair, thanks for having this hearing tonight. My name is Dave Engstrom. I am a board member of the Friends of Washington County. Chairman Bill Polkerbeck and Commissioner Myra Peterson of Washington County were scheduled to be here tonight, but could not be here. I'm just going to give a little background and introduce the, and we're going to be very brief because we know the lateness of the hour and we're going to move quickly here. Friends of Washington County was formed several years ago, long before this issue ever arose. What brought us out of the woodwork and here tonight was a proposal in Washington County for a landfill site, and the legislation that that you all passed in 2008. And we became concerned, and we've had some issues of groundwater contamination in Washington County. Our board, it's a bipartisan board. I think you have a handout that lists all of our board members. There's you have a, I think, a handout with 4 points on it that lists all of the board members. So we are a bipartisan board, and we've taken interest in several issues over the years. This is one. The groundwater and landfill issue is something that we have opted to work on. We think it is a statewide issue. It is not a Washington County issue. Now, I'm going to make a couple points. You can easily read the 4 points that we've made in that paper that's in front of you. We think that there should be more done to protect our groundwater when siting landfills. And we're talking new landfills. We are not talking existing landfills. That has been our issue all the way along. In the siting of new landfills, there needs to be more done to protect our groundwater. We don't think that the current rules reflect the recent scientific knowledge concerning bedrock conditions in Minnesota. We think the new rules should reflect that. As part of our charge in working on this project, we collected a lot of money and hired some geologists, hydrogeologists, who put together a 41-page white paper entitled Groundwater Sensitivity and Solid Waste Disposal in Minnesota. It was Dr. Calvin Alexander and Stu Grupp were our hydrogeologists that we hired, and I think that was a worthy paper that had some good points. We are trying to develop further some input for rules, and we do want these rules to go on. We're trying to develop further input on hydrogeology and bedrock conditions so that we can have a strong statement. And once again, we think this is important for all of Minnesota, not because of an issue in Washington County. One of the points, and this is the last point on the paper, currently the MPCA, a proposer can come forward, they can propose a site, and the MPCA has to make a judgment. And that judgment is made, and they really don't have the authority to say, hey, there's really a better site 10 miles away or 5 miles away. What happens is it's usually the low land value sites, places that were excavated for gravel or maybe even low ground that might even be have very high water tables that you could not otherwise build on. Those are the sites that are being proposed for landfill, and we think that there should be some authority to say there's a better place to put landfills. With me tonight, I have council member Peg Larson, who's of course a former state representative, also a member of the Friends of Washington County Board, and I think she's going to speak to a little bit of this, and Mayor Dean Johnson of Lake Elmo. So I'm going to turn it over to who's first.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Johnson. Committee members. Thank you very much for staying to this late hour and hearing this. I'll be very brief. And if my community, Lake Elmo.
If you could just state your name for
I'm sorry.
Time.
My name is Dean Johnston, and I'm the mayor of the city of Lake Elmo.
Welcome.
My community is really a poster child for what happens when things go wrong. About 50 years ago, the Washington County landfill was in operation in Lake Elmo, and the Oakdale landfill was operating on our border. In 2004, we discovered chemicals in our landfill. We have had to close wells on 200 homes in Lake Elmo, and we spent $6 to $7 million bringing municipal water to a low-density area that was never planned for municipal water services. Also, in that 50% of Lake Elmo that is in the well advisory area, we have another 200 homes, only 15% of which actually exceed the health-based values, and 3M has placed carbon filters there. But believe me, the other 170 homeowners are very anxious about their drinking the water that their neighbors have to have filtered. They're anxious about the health issues. They're anxious about the retail value, and and we are trying to find another $10 million to bring water to those neighborhoods. So this is, I mean, we're not talking $25 or $30 per household. We're talking the city will have spent almost $17 million because of the contamination in these landfills. I'm all for collaboration. You won't find anyone more supportive of collaboration than I am, and I think there's some very good suggestions for how to deal with existing landfills. But please, I'm here to ask you, almost to plead with you, don't stop your efforts on setting a rulemaking process for new landfills. The impact of a poorly sited landfill is difficult to explain in a short period of time. The existing landfills are a different situation, but I think the legislature was very forward-looking when it asked for this rulemaking process. I think the rulemaking process is good, it's technically necessary, and it will help prevent the kind of things that happen to Lake Elmo. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. And Ms. Larson, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I actually started my political career as a city council person, and now I'm back on the city council of Lakeland. Excuse me. And I am only here tonight to let you know that Lakeland Shores, Afton, and West Lakeland Township have all passed resolutions supporting continuing rulemaking and the blueprints of the Friends of Washington County. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. And are there any questions for our final testifiers here? Okay, seeing none, Representative McNamara.
I have some questions for the MPCA if we're done with these folks.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Mr. Schirkenbach and Ms. Thorvig, Mr. Richardson. Go ahead, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and move real quick, but I didn't want to ask. I was worried my questions at the time would not go as quick as they might go now. I'm concerned. I've heard some conflicting testimony, and I'm trying to look over the bill that we passed off the House floor that night in 2008, and I'm trying to understand. The MPCA says that the moratorium affects everybody everywhere, if I understand you right, except for the exceptions that are listed. But I see some of the exceptions list that lead me to believe that maybe it's not as broad as possibly meaning. But I think it's important that we pass legislation to clean it up. And so I see the words mentioned, reissuance of a permit, expand a permit, or modify the type of waste for landfills that were licensed as of March 1, 2008. Is the MPCA on the same page that if you meet any of those criteria, reissuance of a permit, expand a permit, or modify a permit, if you were operating on March 1, 2008, you can do all those things still?
Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, these are exceptions to the moratorium. So we can reissue permits, we can modify permits, we can do those things that you said before we have rules, because they're exempted from the moratorium. And we would do that under our current rules, not under these proposed new rules.
Representative McNamara.
So all those facilities aren't subjected to this legislation. They're not, they're subjected to the legislation, but we're not restricting them. So any existing one that wants a reissuance of a permit can get it if they want to expand and it's within the criteria listed within 600 yards or touches or modifies, because I was under the misunderstanding. So all those are exempt. They can go forward.
They're exempt from the moratorium. They would be subject to the new rules if we adopted new rules.
And if I can say, Mr. Chair, I mean, that's part of the, there's two different issues here. One is what could happen before a new rule was adopted, and the other one is what was the scope of the new rule? Two different issues that there was some confusion about as we were looking at the language.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, and then this next one is very interesting to me. I'm not sure where we were coming from when we did this one. A permit to modify the type of waste accepted at a land disposable facility operating as of March 1, 2008. That leads me to believe that every facility in operation as of March 1, 2008 would be okay, because any permit they would want, wouldn't it modify potentially what they're doing? So how can this apply to any existing facility?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, the moratorium that's in place until we adopt new rules did exclude all existing landfills. So you're right. The moratorium was only in place for certain new landfills that don't fall within this criteria, because even some new facilities are excluded from the moratorium under this language. Mm-hmm. But this is only from the moratorium, not the rulemaking, mm-hmm. in our view.
Representative McNamara.
Okay, well, I just wanted to get that on the record so that where we're at on that, in case this place blows up and we don't get new legislation, at least I got an idea where it's at. If I could go back, it looks to me, we've heard some testimony about the lack of, for lack of a better way of describing it, two legs of the stool. I'm very concerned about the site and the groundwater and all that. Representative Bond and Representative Wagenius, and I was supportive of the legislation. I think that's real important. But I'm wondering, oftentimes when we do this legislation on the floor, late at night, different than the way it was in committee, did we miss something? And should we, well, I've got to maybe reword it, would it have been beneficial if we'd have said engineering should be considered? I go back to the simple little analysis that I asked Mr. Robertson about, when I remember saying, why not have three layers if two is good, and these people are really worried and I'm worried for them? Why would we not take into the value of engineering? Maybe they got some conditions that we can fix with engineering.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara. Again, part of this is, that's what we can do. I should go back. We had kind of a catch-22. In this whole time frame, we first had to deal with the first issued CDNI industrial and that group that was there. And maybe that's why I'm here, partially to say maybe I should have called the question earlier about all this, because we were also dealing with the solid waste policy report and the whole stakeholder group there and dealing with all this at this time. What I'm saying is we're here to get clarification. So we're trying to understand exactly then. We're glad these issues have been brought up. And again, the only thing is a draft rule. It wasn't even a full rule, a draft under the Chapter 14, because we hadn't even done a statement of need and reasonableness. In fact, maybe we set ourselves up by even putting some type of a draft or a straw proposal out there, so at least we could make sure the issues were kind of all brought together and everybody could get the full sense of it. There was no way we were going to get to full draft rules during the time frame that we had. So we put together something at least to try to get the discussion kind of converged together knowing that we had the issues, as Lisa said earlier, about the time frame, the 18 months, and there's also the issue of how the moratorium affects these issues as well. How far does the moratorium apply? So that's why we're saying here. So rather than looking at it and saying all these different issues such as variances and that, we just took some approaches to get it out on the table. The variance one was used because right now we have rules on variances. There's always questions on what discretion we can have without having covering and dealing with the administrative law that's already covered under our rules. So that's why I use the variance. We understand it's a pretty cumbersome process. There's other ways when we have more time that we can figure out to lay out some criteria that then maybe the commissioner, using those criteria, can make a judgment on allowing other approaches to be used. If we have time, that's the type of thing we were doing. We had a lot of this compacted down in a pretty tight time frame in the first place.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the latitude here at the late hour. Well, Deputy Commissioner Schirkenbach, the other one I want to ask about is, what about it? Doesn't seem like we put in the type of waste, and I really believe, I mean, we do want to regulate because people could put hazardous waste in a C&D landfill. I realize that, and that's why we got the waste cops, for lack of better people, but you got somebody there in your department that goes to the landfills and checks on it. But I think Representative Saylor brought up a good point. I think when we tore down our cabin up north and we hauled that waste from 25 miles to Brainerd where we brought it, and my neighbors say, why are you hauling it away? You could just, you know, put it in the fire, have a bonfire tonight or whatever. And I mean, I don't know what was all in that cabin, what we were doing. If we would have, instead of going to Brainerd, we were supposed to go to St. Cloud, I don't know, we're starting to ask some pretty hard questions here. And that's why it seems like the type of waste we should also be considered, whether it's, and I don't know that we did that. I mean, go forward, I think, shouldn't we?
Mr. Sherpin,
Chairman, I'll let Ms. Tharvig respond to that.
Ms. Tharvig.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, we have existing solid waste rules that we think are satisfactory to address waste type and engineering requirements. And we do differentiate if it's a demolition landfill that is small size, we require less engineering requirements than if it's an industrial waste landfill or municipal waste landfill. So this direction from the legislature was not about going back and redoing all of the solid waste rules. We have a body of solid waste rules that address engineering and waste type that the legislature didn't question, and we're not suggesting that we open up and start to address those rules. What the legislation asked is that we also consider location as another way to protect against risk through this legislation, and we have taken a shot at it with the idea that the legislature is going to look at it and provide additional advice. So, like Mr. Schirkenbach said, we're happy that people are looking at it and providing comments. One thing I do want to talk about is the setbacks, which are in current rules. And actually, the Rochester landfill was subject to those setbacks when we permitted that facility, and we did exempt them from those setbacks because we agreed that was the best site in Rochester. So what we tried to do was try to clean up some of the setback language, and we're deciding to drop that completely from this rulemaking. We'll live with the current setback language and the disparity, and it's scattered all over the place, and we don't intend to change the way we deal with setbacks. So I think the issue is, does the legislature want to continue on a rulemaking that talks about protection of sensitive groundwater areas? We've identified what we think that is. And if so, does the legislature want it to apply to new landfills only or new and existing landfills? And if you're asking us to go back and say whether it should apply to demolition landfills as well as other landfills, we haven't done that. That could be additional clarification. If the legislature says, yes, existing, but now go back and look at whether it should apply to demolition landfills as well as you know, if it should include all existing or different types. I don't know if that's what you're saying.
Okay. I'm going to quit.
Okay. Representative Wagenius. Yes.
Given on the financial assurance, given the current state of engineering that you require, will private insurance companies insure these landfills?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we're hearing rumblings that insurance companies may be starting to insure landfills. We don't know of any. We don't have, I mean, we've just heard rumors. We don't have specific evidence. We don't. And I don't know if any of the Minnesota private landfills have insurance.
Perhaps.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Just a comment. Perhaps Mr. Robinson, Mike Robertson, with the chamber can see if any of its chamber members will insure these landfills. I think that just changes the question a little bit.
Okay. Sure. And Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. One final quick comment. At least what I think I heard tonight or this afternoon and tonight from pretty much all the testifiers, even appreciate the friends from Washington County, that let's not mess with the existing landfills, but let's put some of these new siting requirements on new landfills. And that seems to me to be the way to go, to let our existing landfills, those operating correctly and doing a good job, let's not subject them to these new rules on siting, at least. So that would be my take on the committee hearing tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson and Ms. Thorvig.
I'd like to just make one quick comment on that. The problem that when you start to grandfather in existing facilities and you put much more onerous requirements on new facilities, what you start to do is you start to close off the option of building new state-of-the-art facilities. It doesn't matter if it's landfills or coal-fired power plants or whatever. And so I think you have to think hard if you want to put the requirements only on new landfills. It almost keeps you continuing to expand and use old landfills that don't have the state-of-the-art equipment. And that's why in our proposed rules, we felt like these requirements should apply to existing, but over a longer period of time. Phase them in. And we do have more work to do, I think, with the stakeholders. We agree with that. But that's the only problem if you start to set up much more onerous requirements for new, and it doesn't ever start to apply for the existing. You start to continue to use the existing, and you never get the newest technology in. And I don't know if that's good for Minnesota in the long term. It is your decision, but I did want to just note that caution for your consideration.
And Mr. Chair, just and
Mr. Shurkin,
that's a lesson learned relative to even the Clean Air Act, where they had a big, bright line between existing facilities and new source facilities. And what they found is then they continued to just retrofit and work on the old facilities and expand those or build off of those or whatever else. So it's just a consideration where when you're looking at that, that'll be one of the factors to understand.
Okay, thank you for that. And something else I've heard, too, and coming from the PCA, was the need for some clarification, I think. And obviously, if we're going to move forward with changes, that's going to require reauthorization legislation. And in that, I think there maybe has to be some clarification, too, as far as how to treat existing facilities as opposed to moving into the future and also addressing, I think, the financial assurance issue as well. So. Any other questions before we adjourn? Seeing none, thank you for staying so late. Meeting adjourned.